from the Sky News Centre at 5. We're just hearing police investigating the disappearance of Georgia Williams are searching land near Wrexham. The 17-year-old hasn't been seen since leaving her home in Wellington in Shropshire on Sunday. One man's been arrested. Ruth Lowe owns local pub The Plough and says Georgia's dad is struggling.
He popped in on Wednesday, went and said his prayers with his wife in the church, came back to drop the lighter off. Walked in and saw his daughter's face on the TV, on the news, and it was just, he just broke down. They both just broke down in tears.
Woolwich murder suspect Michael Adebolajo has been discharged from hospital and taken into custody. He's at a South London police station where he's also been arrested on suspicion of the attempted murder of a police officer. Today, detectives investigating the death of drummer Lee Rigby have arrested two men on suspicion of being involved in the supply of illegal firearms. An official report has revealed a British Airways plane which made an emergency landing at Heathrow last week had both engine doors left unlatched after maintenance. One piece from a door came loose, piercing a fuel pump on the BA flight to Oslo last Friday. David Gleave is an aviation safety investigator.
The failure to do up the cowlings is not a terribly significant safety issue. When the cowling fell off, yes, it did damage a fuel pipe and there was a fire, but I don't think that the structural integrity of the aeroplane, that the whole safety of the aeroplane was not jeopardised because the crew were able to shut the engine down quite safely.
The MP Patrick Mercer has resigned the Tory whip to save his party embarrassment. It's over allegations he's broken lobbying rules. That's the latest. I'm Anna Jones.
You can listen to BCFM live on the internet and also download every show as a podcast at bcfm.org.uk.
Well, folks, it's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Helping us review this week's news is the newly elected Labour councillor for St George East, Steve Pearce. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Prime Minister David Cameron, leader of the Human Shields, Nick Clegg, and Chancellor of the Exchequer George Osborne want their pound of cuts. And the fire service apparently will be no exception. Does that mean if you call 999, a fire engine might turn up too late? I'm joined by Phil Jordan from the Fire Brigades Union. The Bristol meeting of the People's Assembly Against Austerity took place on Wednesday evening this week with local guest speakers as well as comedian Mark Steele and independent columnist Owen Jones. Steve Timmins from Protect Air NHS in the city is here to explain what the People's Assembly is all about. Plus, drones flown by remote control or by a computer, they're killing increasing numbers of innocent people. One joint US university study estimated 50 innocent civilians are dying for every terrorist suspect in Pakistan that's killed by a drone strike. Well, Barack Obama may joke about killing his critics in the US with drones, but one side of all this is very, very happy. The companies that make the drones. And Lockheed Martin that makes Hellfire missiles. Well, should Lockheed Martin's shareholders and directors be prosecuted for aiding and abetting murder and war crimes? Plus, Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 12 Celsius and mainly dry. This weekend, highs up to 16 and a sunny weekend. Next week, highs of 20. Gosh, getting properly warm now, and a fairly warm and sunny week. Next weekend, the 8th and 9th of June, a Bilderberg weekend over in Watford. Highs of 20, fairly sunny for the Bilderberg Fringe Festival. And that was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is the newly elected, I don't want to call him new Labour councillor, the newly elected Labour councillor for St George East, Steve Pearce. Hi, Steve, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
What do you make of New Labour, Steve? I just mentioned you're a New Labour councillor, but what do you make of New Labour?
Well, New Labour, it's quite old now.
It is. It was
really?
1997.
It was new in 97. It's not quite so new now, and with rank and file members, it's not quite as popular as it used to be.
Okay. What's your background. What brought you to become a councillor, and what do you bring to managing the city's budget?
Well, I'm on the old industrial wing of the Labour Party, really. I suppose if you had to call me anything, you could probably get away with calling me a Benite.
What about your own experience, your own personal professional background or whatever?
Right, well, I did 30 years in the chemical industry.
In Bristol?
Industrial worker, shop floor worker down at Avonmouth. It used to be part of the Rio Tinto group, but then got moved on to a French multinational who ultimately had to close it down.
So who were you actually working for down at Avonmouth?
It was the Rhodia company, yes.
Okay, and what sort of things do you experience as a union rep down there that sort of you think you bring to your experience as a councillor?
Well, apart from just dealing with people and involvement in the pension scheme and lots of finance, but most of the experience I bring is through being a community activist for a long time. So
so where do you actually live?
I live in Brislington. Live in Brislington on the other side of the river. And both are nice. I regret to say I can't actually afford to live in St George.
Okay. What about as a community activist? What have you done as a community activist? Give us an idea.
Run boxing clubs, run all manner of fun days, helped organisations get off the ground. I've been a trustee for domiciliary care charities. I've helped to run local neighbourhood centres, children's after-school play schemes, pensioners' lunch clubs. You name it, I've probably had a go at it.
What brought you to the Labour Party rather than one of the other parties? We've also got the Greens, of course, in the city now, and independents. Why do you decide to go with the party politics? Because the obvious thing to ask you is that the trend seems to be the opposite. The trend seems to be independents or ex-Lib Dems, people seem to be rejecting this idea of party politics because they see the parties as far too narrow. That the idea really is to have politicians now in the city, like George Ferguson, the mayor, who's actually independent of all that.
There's a lot in there, isn't there? Okay. Yes, I mean, people do seem to be tired to an extent of party politics. I would say that they should get involved and change them from the inside, which is what I decided to do. For a long time, I was very active in local politics with a small p.
What do you mean by that? Where?
In Brislington. I was very active in Brislington in politics with a small p. And the reason it was politics with a small p was because I was having to deal with councillors from the three main political parties. And if you wear your heart on your sleeve in a situation like that, it's great while your party are in office or in power, but as soon as they're not, you're not terribly popular all of a sudden. So had to do that. The 2010 election came around and I decided, and the result that we had, and I decided, right, well, I'm going to just have to be very public about what I do and get involved and front up and do it. So that was what brought me out from under the rock.
And what do you make of the national leadership of the party? Because I'm afraid Ed Miliband isn't doing too well in the hearts and minds of the public. He consistently seems to come out as one of the least trusted opposition leaders ever. What do you make of the national leadership?
Yeah, I find that difficult to understand because Ed was the first of the leaders of the party. Ed was the first out of the blocks when it came to dealing with the whole Murdoch thing. And I think he showed a lot of courage in doing that, and I think he's shown courage in a number of other areas.
But I mean, for example, when it came
and he doesn't seem to be getting the credit that he ought to be getting.
For example, when it came to the vote on the benefit cap, for example, the idea that they were going to keep it down to 1% every year, even if inflation is 20%, God forbid, but if it is, the benefits are only going to be increased at 1% a year. So this is really driving, maybe many, many, many millions of people down into well below the poverty line, and yet Ed decides, well, I know, I'm going to make a decisive action here. We're going to abstain.
Yeah, you know what? I'm a member of the Labour Party. That doesn't necessarily mean I agree with everything that the party does. The party is, oh, we're going to use that hackneyed phrase now, it's a broad church, isn't it? But I don't enjoy or approve of everything that the party does, but I try to change it from within. One of the things I don't like is we've recently had this snoopers charter thing, and I'm not entirely sure that we're making the right decision on that one either, but that's something else that I should be beavering away at, trying to change from within the party.
Okay, but how have you been, what have you been up to, that your first, what is it, 2-3 weeks in office? Are you on committees, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's a very steep learning curve, I've got to tell you. I'm now on the Sustainable Development and Transport Scrutiny Commission. It's always nice to start off with something easy, and what's the first thing that happens? We get the mayor's RPZs.
This is the residence parking zone. What's your thoughts?
Was the first thing that came in front of us. I'd been involved in that for about 10 minutes, and we're straight into residence parking zone. So nice to start on something easy.
What are your thoughts on it, though? Because it's one of those issues that it seems that the mayor has actually now got the mandate to deal with. Over the years, you've got whole areas of the city being used as car parks, loads of cars parking on the pavements, etc. A real mess. Someone's got to sort this out, surely, eventually.
Yes. Having said that, the fact that the mayor's got involved in what seems to be a very heavy-handed fashion, he wants to almost carpet bomb half of the city with residence parking zones.
But haven't you got to do it all at once? Isn't that part of it?
No,
if you try and do one area, then another area. No,
I don't think you can. I'll be honest with you, I don't think that the city's got the resources to be able to do it and do a proper job of it. If you're going to do something like that, you need some baseline figures. You know, you need to know how many people live in an area and how many cars they own and how many of those cars leave that area in the morning. And then you need to know how many cars are coming into that area, bringing how many commuters, where they're travelling from. Have they got any option? I mean, they could be coming from somewhere where there is no public transport. They may have no option other than to bring a car. We haven't got any of that information. None. That became all too obvious at the Scrutiny Commission meeting earlier in the week.
Well, it's fantastic,
Steve.
We just don't know. Sounds to me like you're asking the right questions as part of this Scrutiny Commission.
Well, I'll be honest with you. If I wanted to implement a residence parking zone, these are questions that I would be asking first and foremost. You can't make a good decision if you've got bad information. And not only do we not have good information, we don't have any information, never mind bad information.
Well, it sounds a bit worrying. What's your prediction then? You gaze into your crystal ball. Is this all going to happen next year?
I suspect it will, but it will take a lot longer than the mayor's hoping for. Unfortunately, the stance that the mayor has taken has meant that communities that are desperate to have these residence parking zones, and rightly so, places like Clifton and Hot Wells. Clifton Wood, the people in Clifton Wood are absolutely crying out for this. They should have had it a long time ago. And now, because of the furore that's been kicked up over this, there's lots of opposition to it. It's sure to end up in front. I understand that the council has already been threatened that it'll be disappearing off to the ombudsman over this, and probably there'll be lawyers waiting in the wings, no doubt. So actually, for the people of Clifton Wood and Hotwell, for the people of Clifton Wood, it should be a case of get on and do it. Get the signs up, get the lines painted. There's no objection. I think they've got 86% of people in Clifton Wood are in favour of a residence park.
So
they should have it.
Yeah. So where there's agreement, do it.
Get on and do it. Absolutely, get on and
no
do it.
Delay.
People want it. Get on and do it. Get it done. Let's get get these people a decent quality of life. But where people don't want it, then I think you have to persuade them. And over time, if we can show that the benefits that accrue, air quality in Bristol is appalling. Something that came out at the Scrutiny Commission meeting was that air quality in Rupert Street is 4 times worse than permissible levels. 160 micrograms of NO.
Where's Rupert Street?
Rupert Street is down by the Bridewell.
Okay.
And a lot of that is going to be down to the heavy bus traffic that's going through there, I guess. Lots of particulates.
Well, anyway, I think the idea of your residence parking thing, well, we'll see how that all goes. But, Steve, ultimately, this is a dictatorship, isn't it, for 4 years, pretty much, for the mayor. And he can do what he wants. I mean, that's what the people have elected him to do.
I'm glad that you used that word.
It's not quite a dictatorship. You don't get a dictator normally stays in for as long as they can, don't they?
Yes, yes.
George has been given the mandate by the people to do this for 4 years, and he's decided how to do it.
Yes, he has. Perhaps it was an idea that he thought up in the bath. But he's upset a lot of people. There are going to be a lot of unintended consequences along with this. Some of the stories that we read in the paper, and they can't all be wrong, are horrific.
Well, give us an example.
Okay, I'm going to mention a car manufacturer's name, the Nissan garage on Pennywell Road. Front page of the paper, 75 employees, 60 customers a day, 2 parking spaces. The boss there apparently is talking about moving his business out of the city, potentially.
Okay. There's also plumbers.
That doesn't look good.
People who are servicing washing machines, plumbers, they're all saying the same sort of thing, aren't they?
Yes.
You know, if we're in somebody's house for an hour fixing their washing machine, we're going to come out with a ticket on the back, or else we're going to... I mean, do you think ultimately then this is a bit of a... I mean, we've been discussing this over previous weeks, but a cash cow, so that whenever the council needs a bit of money, they can tweak up the amounts over the next sort of 20, 30 years?
Well, it's very tempting to think that, and the way that the charges are going up is really, really amazing. I think from £30 a year to £48 a year for a first car. That's quite a swinging increase. Plus, if you stick it on a large area, that's an awful lot of 48 quids you're going to be collecting.
All right, Steve. Anyway, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Martin, this week, the front page of The Independent, Osborne faces £8 billion shortfalls. The ministers refuse the cuts. The Chancellor's apparently going to use cabinet interrogation to break the wills of government ministers who've rejected his reductions he wants to impose on them. 7 ministries have reached a deal, but the overall budgets for 2015 have been trimmed by only £3 billion. He's still got £8 billion to go, Martin.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because a lot of these ministers that are resisting this were gung-ho for a cuts policy and very keen, and you know, they tend to be the more right wing of the ministers. But of course, when it's their turf that's being cut, they're not that interested, because in actual fact, cutting public expenditure is really difficult to do. It's like saying, yes, we've got to cut our leg off, but it's going to hurt. And people say, no, hang on a minute, let's think about it.
Well, some of the main departments are the Home Office, the Business Department and the Ministry of Defence are putting up strong resistance. Do you think maybe this message from the IMF last week saying that Osborne's cuts policy is all wrong, effectively, is kind of giving them a little bit of courage, you know, to say, well, actually, Osborne, we're not going to do this. Well, and if so, I mean, how tenable is his position if he hasn't got the confidence of the ministers and or the IMF? Whose confidence has he got? Only, it seems, David Cameron's.
Well, I think this is interesting, because the ministers that are resisting the cuts are the same kind of people who've been saying the IMF should just shut up and butt out. It's just that if you're asking for logical consistency from these people, you're asking a lot, because, of course, the whole policy is a farrago of nonsense.
Well, they didn't actually say that. They didn't actually say that last week. They were sitting there quietly, and I suppose looking at George, and with the IMF giving their pronouncements, looking at George Osborne, saying, well, maybe you better listen to these guys.
Yeah, but
I mean, maybe they're the sorts of people that will go whichever way the wind blows. If the IMF says the thing that they want them to say, they'll agree with them. Otherwise, they won't.
Well, that may be so, but I think you will find that one of the problems they've had up to now is that the Tory party in general has actually become more super Thatcherite, especially with the death of their cult leader recently, than they were before. In fact, they're more extreme than they were in the 80s. But at the same time, they don't want to cut their departmental budgets. Well, really, I mean, you know, it just makes me laugh, really. I mean, the inconsistency.
What about the pressure on Osborne? How long can he last with this sort of thing? Because, like I say, you've got international pressure on him. There seems to be only one person that's actually backing Osborne anymore, and that's David Cameron himself.
Yes, because Osborne will be thrown to the wolves if it all goes horribly wrong, and Cameron will just say, nothing to do with me, Gov. That's the strategy there, isn't it?
Interesting bit of news last week, which was the entrance exam for Eton, which came out. Interesting article in the New Statesman about that, for 13-year-olds, asking them if 25 protesters were killed, how would you justify it? And asking people who are entering Eton to come up with an answer. Can I ask you two, both two, Labour Councillor for St George East, just elected Steve Pearce, how would you justify if 25 protesters were killed? How would you justify it as part of the Eton entrance exam?
I don't think I could. I really... It's a bold question to ask someone so young. I suppose they must think they've got a very high
quality. Just say you really wanted to get into Eton. What would you say? Just give us a sentence.
Please let me in. My dad came too.
Okay. Martin, what about you? If you wanted to justify... Come on, give it a go, please. 25 protesters have been killed. How do you justify it?
They opened fire on us first, like in Syria.
Okay.
Except it might or might not be true.
But I mean, there is a serious side to this, isn't there? If you're asking 13-year-olds these questions, how are they supposed to answer if they want to get into Eton?
Well, I mean, it's actually the exam, I understand, was not actually the full entrance exam. It's to be a King's Scholar, which gets you a grand off your 10 grand term fees. So that's all we're talking about here. And of course, they're grooming future British prime ministers, aren't they? Because that's the sort of thing they're going to be asked. Because I'm afraid the British army is all over the world shooting protesters as we speak. So it's a fairly common question to be asked, isn't it?
Well, what are your thoughts about that as a question, though, Steve?
I mean, as a question, I think it's... I'd be very uncomfortable. Before I worked in the chemical industry, I trained to be a teacher. And I'd be very uncomfortable about asking anyone that was potentially in my charge questions like that. I think asking someone a question like that is surely bordering on abuse, isn't it? Isn't that abusive?
Well, I mean, surely the question is, what were the actual circumstances of whatever took place?
Well, apparently some police had been killed as well. Was it one or two police? Yeah,
well, that may be the case. But actually, I think just asking the question...
13-year-old.
Asking the question 13-year-old. Of 13-year-old. I think that's pretty
young,
abusive. Yeah, I think as a councillor, if I heard that someone in a local authority school was asking youngsters questions like that, I'd be asking some pretty awkward questions as well, I think. And actually, I think the people that voted for me would be expecting me to ask pretty awkward questions as well.
Martin, can you say something about the whole sort of Eton culture? Because it does seem that there's quite a lot of people getting into various powerful positions. I mean, in the newspapers, in politics, all sorts, in banking, business, the Bullingdon Club, then going off to Oxford. What are these Eton people like?
Well, I couldn't honestly say because I haven't been. I used to watch these people from a distance when I was at Oxford University, and frankly, I didn't mix much with them because we had other better things to do. They were fairly loud, I seem to remember. They acted as if they owned the place.
Well, many of them are bankers. And there's my link into our Vox Pop this week. Marina Morris has been out on the streets asking you what you think about Mervyn King and various other people's requests not to bash the bankers anymore.
The governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, says it is time to stop bashing bankers. Do you agree?
Kind of yes and no, because I think they get a lot of, like, hate for what stuff they've not even done. Like, it's not even upset. My stepdad was a banker at one point, and he got a lot of crap for stuff he didn't deserve. Like, it's not even his choice. So, yeah, I think they do, but at the same time, I think the banks could be a lot better than what they are.
No, my opinion is the financial system really isn't fixed in any way, shape, or form from the problems that they experienced back in 2008. Their accounting is still not great. You can see that by the fact that their stock is still really undervalued. Genuinely concerned that we're going to have another serious economic collapse.
I'd be quite biased because I used to be a banker. They tend to only attack the really high up ones, and it tends to be the middle management which are the problem. So yes, by all means bash the bankers, but bash the right ones. I do think bankers are edging more towards commercial than individual, definitely, but I think people don't help themselves either sometimes, so it's kind of 50-50 battle. But yeah, the bank should do more for individuals. When it comes to companies, they'll fall over themselves to help you, but when it comes to individual help, they're not so useful.
I'd say overall, yeah, it's, with the economy not great as it is, it's let's bash the bankers and blame them for everything. But if the government actually looked at themselves, they're pretty much to blame as well, you know. They're not innocent in all this, and they just want to pass the blame and pass the buck to somebody else, which is pick on the bankers 1 month, pick on the NHS another one, pick on somebody else another time. So overall, yeah, it's like, well, you know, sort your own stuff out and then blame other people afterwards.
I do agree, but then at the same time, I think if we don't bash bankers, then how are they going to know when we need something changed? So it's one of those things. The government mostly, because they're the ones that spend all the money. They're the ones just like wasting it away. And obviously the bank managers, because they're the ones that are deciding what to do with the money. So yeah.
Bilderberg member Mark Carney will be the new boss of the Bank of England. Will he be any better? And have you heard of the Bilderbergers?
Possibly, yeah. I think it could be changed, because I mean, it might be better, it might be worse, but we don't ever know. Because he could bring better things to the table, but at the same time, he could bring worse things. So, not at all. I've never heard of that in my life. Never. But I reckon they shouldn't keep much secret, I'll be honest. I don't think if it's to do with people's money and stuff like that. And
nah, he's ex-Goldman Sachs, so he's going to be just as bad. So, yeah.
Yeah, but I wouldn't say it's a secret society. They meet in Switzerland every year and talk about things. They're just people like businessmen and financiers, but I don't really buy into any of that conspiracy stuff. I think they're very, very transparent in what they do. But yeah, I've heard of them, yeah.
I don't know. I don't know enough about him or his history in business to tell you if he'd be better or not. That's an individual thing. If he got the job, he must be good enough to do it. So let him prove himself.
Well, he can't do any worse. It's pretty much it, yeah. A new guy, give him a chance, and he can't do any worse than what they've already done, so hopefully things will get better.
No, to be honest.
No, can't say I have. It's because they want to keep it to themselves, really. Obviously, those at the top want to put people in they already know and already trust, I suppose. So that's probably not a good thing.
Then again, they could just want to discuss things on a level playing field where they know that people aren't just going to turn around and steal their ideas. You need someone to talk to who understands where you're coming from or in a similar position, so you can get advice and learn how to improve things without being stabbed in the back.
I don't know. I have no idea. He might be, he might not be, but we'll just have to wait and see, won't we? No, I've never heard of it. No.
Well, discussion there about whether to bash bankers or not, and also about the secretive Bilderberg group, which is meeting. It's one of the elite of the NATO zone, including royalty, who meet in secret every year, a meeting in Watford next weekend, at the end of next week. Martin, first with you, Mark Carney. I think everyone is basically saying give him a chance, and many have never heard of this Bilderberg organisation, But one or two, or one, at least one, mentioned Goldman Sachs. Give us an idea of what you think. Is Mark Carney going to make any difference when he takes over from King Mervyn?
Not really, because the situation is so dire. I mean, that's what people don't seem to realise.
Well, they're saying it couldn't get any worse, somebody said then.
Well, I'm afraid that's just not true. However bad it is, it can always get worse. And I'm afraid the last few years were the opportunity to try and sort out the financial sector. It wasn't taken. Mark Carney is a steady-as-he-goes sort of Bilderberg chap, but I'm afraid the problems are far, far deeper than most of those people seem to realise.
What about you, Steve? You're St George East Labour councillor, newly elected. Have you heard of these Bilderbergers?
No, I've not. But I have heard of Mark Carney, and I read an article a couple of weeks ago that said that Mark Carney's real gift was in knowing when to get out of Canada. Yeah. Because the wheels are just about coming off over there now. So he's been able to get out of the frying pan, and I guess he's hoping that he's not leaping into the fire. But I mean, as to the question that you were asking in your vox pop there about bashing the bank, I don't think we have bashed the bankers.
No.
How many bankers have we actually locked up? These bankers, you know what? They were having their accounts signed off as well. It was a, it was an entire house of cards. All of these assets that they had on their books, and they weren't worth, they were worth very little. And it was, it wasn't until people actually started saying, hang on, this stuff isn't worth anything. And that was when daylight dawned and it all went horribly wrong in 2007 and 2008, when people realized that actually what they thought was were valuable assets were worth nothing. And people say, oh, nobody saw it coming. Actually, we all saw it coming. A lot of this went wrong on the basis of what houses were valued at, particularly in the States. But there isn't anybody listening to us now who hasn't at some point in the last 30 years, and all this started with Reaganomics and Thatcher and the Big Bang, there isn't anyone in the last 30 years who hasn't walked down the high street, looked in an estate agent's window and said, £250,000 for that rabbit hutch, that's ridiculous. And whilst they've said £250,000 for that rabbit hutch, what they're actually, what they're actually giving voice to is the idea that, ooh, hang on a minute, that looks like an asset bubble, that'll probably not end well. And well, they were all right.
What do you mean by an asset bubble? Just explain, what does that term mean?
The prices were chased up on what we would call a wall of money. They weren't worth more. It was just the price had gone up. So I remember when I first went for a mortgage, I thought I was robbing the building society blind. I expected an officer of the constabulary to put his hand on my shoulder as I walked out the building society door when they offered me 2.5 times my salary with a 10% deposit. I thought, I'm getting away with blue murder here. And yet, what have we had recently? We've had 5, 6, 7 times multiples. It's clearly ridiculous. And it's not because houses are worth more. It's because people are able to borrow more money and you get into a bidding war. And the bidding war, it's like if you're in any auction, if you've got 2 or 3 or 4 willing buyers who are prepared to pay any amount of money, they'll chase the price up to wholly unrealistic levels. And that's what's happened here.
Martin, what about this idea? I mean, it's quite interesting hearing Steve saying there that bankers haven't actually been bashed at all.
No, I think that's right. And they're very, very powerful, these people, and they're very well connected, and they've got an awful lot of money. So they are floating this whole idea that it's time to stop bashing us. And in actual fact, as Steve points out, they haven't been bashed enough. If you are rigging the LIBOR rate over 8, 10, 12 years, we're talking about billions of pounds that have been thieved there from the major local authorities in the US. If we're going to send somebody to prison for a year and a half...
It's not just them, is it?
But it's not a victimless crime, is the point I'm making.
Your mortgage rate is going to be determined by LIBOR.
Yeah.
The return that you get on your investment.
Exactly.
That is going to be affected. With another hat on, I'm a pension fund trustee, and I view the rigging of LIBOR through very narrowed eyes.
Yeah. Well, let me just give some
figures for it, because Barclays were fined £290 million, RBS fined £390 million, but this is a £185 trillion a year market. So the fine is roughly the profit from 1 week of 1 year of that fraud, which has been going on from, at least we know, from 2005 to 2009.
Well, that just shows you the scale of the problem we're trying to confront here.
The difficulty is that the scale of the problem is so great that if we really were to put the fraud squad onto the financial sector, and we've had Rowan Bosworth Davis on this show, who was an ex-fraud squad officer, saying exactly this: if we got onto them, then the whole thing would just unravel and collapse. And what will happen, I'm afraid, is it will unravel and collapse in a disorderly fashion. The fraud squad should have been going in there over the last 4 years after Obama was first elected and all the rest of it. Nothing has been done, and therefore it will crash at some point, and even the Labour front bench haven't understood this yet.
Okay, well, one of the things Steve touched on there was the whole idea of auditing, and this is a story this week. Shameless and bungling in the Daily Mail, the tax boss who sullied the civil service. Now, this is the most powerful Mandarin at Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, Dave Hartnett, had a duty to be scrupulously impartial in his dealings with the powerful multinationals whose tax files came across his desk. But his sweetheart deals over lavish lunches and dinners with firms such as Goldman Sachs and Vodafone allowed them to cut millions of pounds off their tax bills. Historically, companies in dispute with HMRC over the size of their tax bills would go to independent tribunals or the High Court, which would adjudicate on the right amount to be paid. But Dave Hartnett's sweetnet deals... He bypassed all that. Now he's been offered a job. He's taken a job, it seems, at one of the auditing firms, Deloitte, which is one of the big four, which is being investigated for price fixing by the Competition Commission.
If it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, maybe it's a duck. I mean, this smells a bit, doesn't it? And there's a lot of it. I mean, it's freely acknowledged that there's a revolving door between the civil service and some of the big consultancy firms and accountancy firms.
Do you think
we know it goes on?
I mean, is this effectively bribery, where he's actually helped these companies get off massive tax bills and they've given him a nice job?
I've been following this story with great interest through the pages of that indomitable research organ, the Private Eye, and it doesn't look good. It doesn't read well. He's given sweetheart deals to companies that should have been, and those decisions should have been vetted by the board, by his board at
HMRC.
HMRC, thank you, at HMRC, and they weren't, and it looks bad, and it looks a bad deal for the UK taxpayer. It looks a very good deal for everybody. For the people that are on the other end.
But Steve, it looks like nobody's even rapping his knuckles. This is the way.
That's right.
I mean, it's almost an expectation that the revolving doors thing is going to happen. That is going to walk out from his job after having helped out these massive companies avoid tax and get a nice job.
Yeah, it does. It does. It absolutely does. And I'd like to see somebody. I'd love Ed to get a real handle on this one. And I think it would be something that electorally would be hugely popular, but actually making a decision on that kind of strategy, that's way above my pay grade.
Okay, yeah. Also, questions for KPMG this week over the audit of the troubled Co-op Bank after the accountancy firm failed to spot impending financial turbulence. Well, this sounds like deja vu, doesn't it, Steve? This is KPMG too. KPMG have a very special place in Bristol's heart, of course, because Mayor Ferguson has a volunteer advisor from KPMG helping him go through the budget for him, for our budget for him.
Yeah.
And a guy called Matt Payne, who we've asked on this programme but haven't received any kind of reply to those requests. KPMG are very much in the same boat. They're facing scrutiny by accountancy watchdogs over its audit of the Co-op Bank. Financial Reporting Council is considering whether to mount an investigation into the firm over its role at HBOS too. In both cases, KPMG failed to spot any signs of looming disaster despite earning millions of pounds in fees, Martin.
Well, yes, I mean, the more we hear about this, I think the problem for the ordinary folk who were being vox pops earlier is they really can't get their head around it because it's just so vast. It's absolutely completely systematic, and lots of people are involved, and the amount of money involved is enormous. And I think what people are hoping is that somehow those people at the top know what they're doing and somehow they're going to get it right. And people will put up with a bit of thievery and bribery and corruption at the top, provided they seem to know what they're doing. But once we hit the wall, as we will, in the not-too-distant future, those ordinary people are going to be sadly disappointed about the situation. And, of course, what we will then end up with is a very small minority, the Occupy Bristol, Occupy Wall Street's 1%, will have all the assets through basically fraudulent means, and everybody else will be left with nothing. And that means a revolutionary situation, I will use that word. In very many parts of the world, it will lead to bloody revolution.
Also, with KPMG, staying on the subject, the BBC also welcome KPMG with open arms, having them up until at least 3 weeks ago when we criticised it on this show, delivering their business news. And the BBC then had a legal challenge through YouTube, because I put the clip up on YouTube of the BBC announcing their business news, read by KPMG, and attempted to take it down. Anyway, I'm very glad to say good old YouTube have said no to the BBC legal department and allowed the YouTube film up anyway, because they were saying, well, basically it was our copyright. Well, effectively, it's not, because what we're doing is we are using an excerpt from the BBC and doing a critical review of it, which comes within fair use terms of the Copyright Act. So just like to advise the BBC about a little bit about copyright law. But ultimately, Steve, what can be done about this? It's not good enough just to hear, I'm sorry, nobody's been prosecuted again and again, is it?
No, it's not. And actually, we're giving KPMG a very hard time, but actually we should be giving all of the big four accountancy firms a very hard time, because they've all signed off accounts that have at some point later on, where, and this is highlighted especially so during the crash, all of these banks, all of these large financial institutions, suddenly we found that they weren't worth what we thought they were worth, and they all had to be bailed out. If not directly by the taxpayer, they had to be bailed out with subsidies into their markets. So either they've not been doing the job properly, or they've been complicit in some kind of criminal activity, perhaps.
I think it is criminal activity. A lot of this is actually, they know what they're doing. It's not just that they've messed up. I think that's fairly clear.
Well, if they have messed up, it's a fairly big mess up, isn't it?
Yeah, well, Peter Galbraith is the son of J.K. Galbraith in the US. He's an academic economist. He's saying what we've got to do is we need to put quite a lot of these people in jail. And in the 1980s, when Reaganomics crashed in the SNL scandal, over 2,000 executives were sent to prison. And that's the way you deal with situations
this
like that.
Okay, investigating.
Okay, on to some local news now. Right. And the police have revealed the names of 8 men charged over the St. George disturbance last Saturday evening. All of them have been bailed to appear at Bristol Magistrates Court in June or July. A walk to raise funds for the Help for Heroes Services charity ended in a 5-hour standoff with police on Church Road on Saturday. By the end of the night, 19 people have been arrested, 12 of whom have been charged or convicted of offences, mostly public disorder. Surprised to hear they've already been convicted, but anyway, the other men accused: Lee Cousins, 40, Jason Bennett, 39, Luke Selman, and 23, have all admitted public order offences. The other men accused are Warren Gardner, 21, of Frampton Cottrell, Jacob Wilshire, 18, of Staple Hill, Paul Lloyd, 39, of Little Stoke, Jason Burt, 24, of Kingswood, Christopher Henwood, 30, of Bristol, Craig Oakley, 40, of Knoll, Andrew Mills, 45, of Nail C, and Wayne Nichols, 34, of Staple Hill. Now, this is on your patch now, isn't
it?
This
strikes me here is that some of these, I mean, a number of them, they're not kids, are they? You know, we've got people here 39, 40, 45, two of 45. I mean, these aren't kids.
Well, what exactly is the problem anyway? Because surely anyone has the right to go shaking tins down the street. Why is this? Why do you think the police have felt it necessary to intervene here?
Well, my understanding of what's gone on here is that we've had an authorised walk collecting money, a charity walk, a money collecting fundraising effort, walking down the street with tins to collect cash for Help the Heroes, which is really laudable, but news of it has got out on social media, and actually it's been hijacked by some far right elements, and that's when the wheels have come off it. And unfortunately, what was a laudable charitable exercise has degenerated into a public order issue, with people being worried and fearful. And one of our local pubs in St George being damaged. So it's not good.
So what do you think, that the police were right to stop these people gathering?
I think in a situation, well,
because I mean, they're in a difficult position. They're heading down towards Easton. Yeah, that was the whole point, wasn't it?
Yes, they're in a very difficult position, because it suddenly becomes very difficult to separate and tell the legitimate fundraisers apart from the far right troublemakers. And as soon as that boundary gets blurred, they, in the interest of order, the police have just got to No, it's no, police heavy-handedness is something that nobody likes to hear, but actually dealing with this with a firm hand was essential, I think.
Martin, the walk was organised after 25-year-old soldier Lee Rigby was hacked to death in Woolwich, London, last week. So, I mean, why shouldn't they be connecting for Help for Heroes?
I mean, I agree with what Steve said about it. That collecting for Help for Heroes is one thing, and trying to march down to Easton and try and have a go at the people in Easton and threaten their mosques and all the rest of it is a completely different kettle of fish. And if people say people should be able to go anywhere, well, that's not what we say in Northern Ireland, is it? We have a lot of rules and regulations surrounding marches, because there has to be.
Walk started peacefully at the Kingswood Royal British Legion Club, where about 30 people gathered. As the crowd made its way around Kingswood, it says in the Post, and into St George, about 60 people congregated in the St George's Hall pub. Just one thought here is that Help for Heroes is not the same as the Royal British Legion, is it? The Royal British Legion is actually mostly old-timers, many of whom actually are very much against the whole sort of war on terror, whereas the Help for Heroes was almost set up to sort of take on the next generation of wars from the previous British Legion types. Any thoughts about that, Steve?
No, not really. I think that there's a case of it's different strokes for different folks.
I mean, for example, the Royal British Legion came out a few years ago saying we think there can be an end to war. We need to end war. And actually quite against this whole concept of the war on terror. Martin?
Well, I think Help for Heroes was deliberately set up by the Murdoch media as an alternative to the British Legion for various reasons. But I think they're a legitimate organisation. And I noticed, for example, that Help for Heroes have refused a donation from the English Defence League.
Well, they're returning the money. They did originally accept it.
Yeah, but they've now said we don't want to take their money. And people have got to be really careful here. Very, very careful. On all sides, whatever side of the community they are on, do you want to live in Belfast? I don't think you do. You want to live in Bristol. So in that case, behave like you live in Bristol. Whatever side you're on.
As a sort of caveat to all of that, BNP leader Nick Griffin has urged his supporters to ignore the police ban on the planned march at the scene of drummer Lee Rigby's brutal murder. Leader of the far-right BNP, Nick Griffin, urged his followers to ignore the police ban on the organisation's planned march near the scene of the murder of drummer Lee Rigby. A call comes despite police warnings any BNP members who try to demonstrate in South East London on Saturday, that's tomorrow, risk arrest. An anti-fascist group whose own counter-march is not currently subject to any ban has said it will go ahead in light of Mr. Griffin's comments, which were made on social media sites a couple of days ago. Officers announced the decision yesterday that the BNP's demonstration was too risky, has told the group to march in Whitehall instead. Martin?
I think what people have got to realise here is that whoever was behind the Woolwich attack, and whatever the actual details of that, whoever did it, what they're trying to do is provoke exactly this kind of social upset. And those who are reacting in this way to the tragic events in Woolwich are in fact playing into the hands of terrorists. You feel like saying to them, do you realise that British soldiers are out on patrol in Afghanistan at the moment, and they are being judged by the locals about what side they're on and whether they're anti-Muslim or not? And if you go out with your anti-Muslim rhetoric, you are risking the lives of British service personnel. Has anybody told the EDL that?
Steve, about this London march tomorrow? It seems that Nick Griffin and the BNP are going to be marching whether the police want them to or not, at the site, or very close to the site of the murder last week.
Well, they may be planning to. I rather suspect that the police will have other ideas about that. I just think that's too inflammatory to do that. And we'll put that down to where it's come from. I don't think that'll happen. I think that'll be stopped. Mr. Griffin and his crew, they can march where the police tell them to. The right to protest, that's something we cherish, isn't it? But actually we have to be fair and reasonable and sympathetic. And the family of drummer Rigby have said that he wouldn't have wanted his death to be used as an excuse for this kind of thing, and so it shouldn't be.
On to some more news. Revealed this week, the true size of the British jobs gap. Some 930,000 new posts are needed for employment rate to return only to the 2008 level, says a think tank. This is Ben Chu. Very well worth following. Ben is in The Independent. The jobs market remains weak and is likely to continue to struggle well into the second half of the decade, making this a more severe downturn for employment levels than the two previous recessions, according to the Resolution Foundation think tank. Martin, 930,000 new jobs are needed.
Yeah, well, I mean, economists have been trying to work out why employment has, or rather unemployment has been coming down in Britain, despite the fact that the economy is dead in the water.
But that only brings us back to 2008 levels.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, don't forget, we've had over a million unemployed throughout my adult lifetime, and I'm 53. So if people think they're going to get rid of unemployment by waving a magic wand, they're kidding themselves. But, of course, the real problem is that the banks are insolvent. And when they crash, the level of unemployment we've got now will be like a stroll in the park. And at that point, we really are going to start asking questions about who's been stealing the money.
I find these numbers very interesting. I mean, this whole thing, as Martin has said, about why unemployment is... seems very low for a recession that is this bad, and clearly something very strange is going on in the unemployment market, in the employment market. I've always thought, but some of these numbers here would make me question it now. If we've got the symptoms would appear to suggest that we've got a lot of these 0 hours contracts, there's a lot of jobs, but not a lot of work. So lots of people getting a phone call saying, oh, you don't need to bother to come in today because we haven't got anything for you. They got a job, but they haven't got any work, so they're not getting any wages. Mm-hmm. But some of these numbers here make me, I've got to scratch my head and look at these numbers again, because something just doesn't add
up. Well, one very interesting thing, of course, is you've got these, the work programme companies that have been set up to deal with the unemployed, like, you know, Tomorrow's People, CTEC and so on. Now, when they are set up, everybody employed in that programme gets counted as an extra private sector job. Yeah, but in actual fact, they are taking over jobs that used to be done by the job centre, which used to be classified as public sector jobs. So an awful lot of this is actually just moving stuff around on the deck chair, on the deck chairs being moved on the Titanic. What used to happen, it was quite hard to get wages down in Britain because of the strength of the trade unions, and people just refused to have their wages cut. Because what's happened in the last 30 years, it is possible to cut people's wages now because people will swallow it. And that means, of course, that the overall demand in the economy continues to go down. You've either got no job or a rubbish job, but demand continues to go down. And at a certain point, that is going to lead to a crash, not just in Britain, but everywhere.
The classic is the 200,000 college lecturer jobs, or similar, that have been transferred out of the public sector nominally into the private sector. I mean, as you say, I mean, this is just accountancy sleight of hand.
Yeah.
But interestingly, I read yesterday, I think, that trade union membership is on the way up again for the first time in a very long time. So...
It's also, I mean,
my comrades in the trade union movement will be very happy.
Still around about 15 times the membership of our political parties, anyway. Yeah. One third of Britons are too poor to join in with the society. Again, this is Andrew Johnson, this time in The Independent. Just under a third of people in Britain are excluded from mainstream society because they can't afford to join in cultural activities such as going to the cinema, taking a holiday, or buying consumer goods. Research for the Joseph Rowntree Foundation shows poorest 30% are also prevented from participating because they have fewer social relationships and less trust in other people. Participating is about belonging. Many of society's expectations require individuals and families to spend money. The report Poverty, Participation and Choice says, like it or not, Britain is a consumer society in which people are assessed according to the income that they have.
And this goes to what Martin was saying just now about demand. People have got no money, they can't afford to go out and have a drink with friends, can't even afford to go out and have a cup of coffee with friends, certainly can't afford to go to the cinema. The last time I went to the cinema, which is longer ago than I care to admit, really, it was pretty expensive then, a night out at the cinema. People can't afford to do that. And you end up with people who are being isolated in their own homes. They're not spending. Because they're not spending, that hits the economy, and hits the economy hard. Nobody's a winner here.
Come on, you're a politician. Where's your solution then?
Oh, good question. Where's my solution? Well, actually, living wage. We've got to look at living wage. Lots of local authorities in the country now have gone for that, and it's an aspiration for us in the Labour Party in Bristol.
No, but we'd
like to see it brought in, and actually that will increase, this is something Martin will be familiar with, the velocity of money in the economy. People will have money in their pockets, but it won't stay in their pockets long. They'll go out and they'll spend that money in their local shops.
I've got some
in their local shops, yeah. Which has got to be good for all
of
us.
I've got some bad news for you. We can't afford it. And also, hardly anybody's actually, the public sector, private sector.
Do you know what? I'm taking that one head on. We can't afford it. We were told at the time that we wanted to introduce the minimum wage that we couldn't afford to do that either. That companies would be going to the wall, left, right, centre, uphill, downhill, nobody would have a job. Guess what? It didn't happen. And I don't see why this should be any different either. And actually, it will reduce an awful lot of the strain on the taxpayer, because we won't be having to pay a lot of in-work benefits to these people who are currently on very poor wages.
Next story, First Group's been haunted by a deal agreed in 2007. Now we know why First Group Chief Executive Tim O'Toole was ready to pay such an insane amount of money to run the West Coast Rail franchise. I think that's also another independent story. Sorry, I don't actually scribble down where that's from. But anyway, it's Alistair Osborne, and I'll put a link on the show's page at thisweek.org.uk later. The adjective was Sir Richard Branson's, his arch rival on last year's bid. But the Virgin King had identified just why a company valued today at £750 million was somehow pledging to repay the taxpayer £13 billion by 2028 for the joys of running the London to Scotland line. Had the government's bid process not careered spectacularly off the rails last October, First Group would have been in line for £50 million of operating profits and £40 million of cash flow annually for the first few years of the franchise. The promised big repayments were years down the track. Money due from the West Coast may not have starved off forever the evil day when the bus and rail operator had to tackle a balance sheet groaning under almost £2 billion of debt. Apparently this is a deal done a long time ago, and this is one of the reasons, of course, why our first bus fares are so expensive, and why many people will say that the actual quality of the service they're providing on the train backwards and forwards to London is so terrible.
Well, this looks to me as though First Group were counting their chickens before they'd been hatched. They were banking on winning this bid process for the West Coast Main Line, and now it hasn't happened. There's egg on faces and to mix metaphors, there's egg on faces and chickens have come home to roost.
So if they knew,
and it looks as though the boss has paid for this with his job, doesn't it?
So also, I mean, if for example they weren't to win rail franchises, say for example they'd lost the West of England franchise that they've got at the moment here, would the company be bankrupt? The bankers would be looking at it saying, you're never going to pay that back, are you?
Well, it's the whole company, the existence of the whole company in its present form begins to look in doubt, I would have thought. And that's not good for Bristol, because an awful lot of our transport infrastructure down to the West Country and in and around Bristol is heavily dependent on First Group. So
okay,
you have to wonder what's happening there.
Sorry, going to have to stop you there. That was newly elected Labour councillor for St George East, Steve Pearce. After the news, Prime Minister Cameron, leader of the Human Shields, Nick